Welcome to Speaking Out.
We're mainly discussing land rights and economic empowerment.
Aboriginal enterprises in mining, exploration and energy.
To talk a little bit about Indigenous constitutional recognition.
With Larissa Berendt.
It's a fresh view coming up.
On ABC Radio.
But I will just say, I mean, I wrote a piece for Archie in the past, a booklet that was published, I think, by the Art Gallery of New South Wales. But I said that, in essence, Archie Moore captured through his art this conflicted landscape and stamps down with authority that we were and remain a sovereign people. And I think that's the essence that comes down through me again from someone like Archie Moore, you know, extremely powerful in his artwork.
The complex thematics in the work of Archie Moore. This is Speaking Out. I'm Larissa Berendt. The work of Gamilaroi Bigambul artist Archie Moore engages with themes of challenging the authority of colonial power while reasserting First Nations sovereignty. This year, he's the featured artist in the Australian Pavilion at the Venice Biennale. His work, Kith and Kin, explores the use of the colonial archive to document and control First Nations people as part of the colonisation process. Archie also looks at the control exerted through current processes like coronial inquests, but he also explores the powerful role First Nations people play in decolonisation. To break down and further examine the ideas in Archie's work, I'm joined by researcher, lawyer and poet Alison Whittaker, historian Professor John Maynard, and researcher, Associate Professor Kirsten Thorpe. Archie Moore's artwork is called Kith and Kin, and kith in the Old English meant knowledge, one's native land and friends and neighbours. We don't sort of think about that very much these days in terms of using that term, but we certainly think about those concepts as First Nations people. And I was just going to start by asking each of you, what do the notions of kinship and connection to country mean to you? And we'll start with you, Kirsten.
Yeah, I guess for me it's thinking about story and taking the time to listen to people that are around you and to take the care and attention of understanding where you are from and how other people are connected with that. I think, you know, even being in the city, you can lose sight of that sometimes. So thinking about those connections and stories are pretty critical.
What about you, Alison?
For me, kinship connects really closely and with responsibility, which the responsibility to listen, as Kirsten has said, but also the responsibility you have to any country that you're on, and also remembering, as people often forget, that the city is country too. We're here on Gadigal country recording today. And that complex network of responsibility is not just something that you feed into, but it's something that nourishes you as well. I could never imagine a world within which, or at least it would be a devastating world where mob couldn't rely on one another.
Lovely. And John, I shouldn't have assumed that this was, as the historian you are, that this was a term that you weren't familiar with. I'm sure you're right across Old English meanings of lots of colonial words.
Absolutely, Larissa. Absolutely. Yeah, for me, knowledge and country is, it's all interconnected. And I mean, that goes back to our place and where we are connected. And you know, if Warramai man, I mean, I regularly go up to Port Stephens and I might do a bit of fishing. I might go to one of the seafood restaurants, but connect to where I come from, and you've come away feeling refreshed. But just to touch on that city thing, and I mean, I speak very often on this issue, is you don't have to be in the Red Centre. You don't have to be in Arnhem Land. You don't have to be in the Kimberley. You might very well be in Melbourne, Sydney, Newcastle or Brisbane, and you can be in close proximity to sites of incredible spiritual significance and cultural significance to Aboriginal people. And people are walking past these places every day and they don't even know it. And that's the reality of that knowledge being disseminated to the wider audience.
Archie's work looks at the ways in which information about First Nations people is kept in archives. Of course, through the process of colonisation, we've been studied, we've been catalogued, and information has been kept about us, often in a way where we're not able to access or even know that it's been taken or what's happened to that information or how it's used. So, Kirsten, what roles have collecting institutions played in the process of colonisation from your perspective?
Yeah, having spent a couple of decades of my life inside the archives as an Aboriginal archivist, I sort of see them now as being a tool of colonisation. I think they're places that people revere because, of course, you know, people need to access them. They're incredibly important for people to connect to family stories and documentation. However, I think there was a side of that power that also damaged Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And their record keeping were used as tools in government policy. So I sort of see them as places of holding really important information, but also being quite traumatic places for Aboriginal people today.
And John, you've worked a lot in the archives yourself as a historian. What are your observations about the way in which information has been kept about First Nations people?
Critically important. I mean, I look back over the last 30-odd years and archives and libraries for a long period, you know, were no go zones for us. We had no idea of the treasures they held, and we were made in those early days to be very uncomfortable in those spaces. And 30 years ago, we had virtually no one operating in the space to assist. The records are, you know, for me, critically important and challenging, that so that we can challenge the histories of the past, which largely ignored us. I'd been saying for a long time, our people's voices can be heard through these records, and particularly when I've gone onto that stuff about the Australian Aboriginal Progressive Association and my grandfather and all those other Aboriginal, early Aboriginal activists, men and women, you know, who were overlooked for such a long period of time, but their voices have been buried in the archives, and it's bringing them back out. And that's inspiration for our mob today, to realise that we've had heroes and heroines in our past. You know, I go back to my school years, there was none of that in the school texts or the school or the history books of that particular time period of the 50s and 60s when I started school. And yet I had that knowledge from home that these sort of histories were there, although I didn't have any idea of the scale of it at that particular point in time. And, you know, that's the importance of it, that we bring these voices back out and can change appreciations of history.
Alison, another aspect of this collection of information is the role that the criminal justice system plays in controlling and surveilling. That's something that Archie does look at in his work as well. So working in this field, what have been your observations about the way in which the criminal justice system has surveilled and controlled?
Surveillance and control are at the very core of the criminal justice system. I'm no historian and I'm no archivist, so I feel a little intimidated by the other members of the panel. But in my work, which has mostly been in the colonial system, I'm really interested in particularly how colonies come to understand our deaths and us as peoples, thinking of us as doomed subjects, people who are doomed to die, which is something we also see in a lot of the discourse around smoothing the pillow of the dying race. And the criminal justice system historically and now has played a role in not only smoothing that pillow, not only participating in the dying and eradication of our people, but also in changing the narrative about it, even as they're doing it. The old narratives of paternalism being for our benefit, moving towards now to this idea of us as pathologically deficit. And you see that a lot with the closing the gap discourse, which mob try to use to our best advantage, as older discourses were also used in the past. There's a limited scope, I think, and this is my tension in archival work, in how much we can speak back to the archive. But as you said, John, I think those voices come through very powerfully in the archive and can speak for themselves.
Yeah, I want to dig into that really good point in a little bit. But John, you've been looking through the archives as part of major work on the New South Wales Protection Board and Welfare Board. And I wonder if you could give us a bit of a scope of what you're finding in it and whether the material's been easy for people to access.
No, I have to say, I mean, it's still the case today that getting access to the records is not easy, and a lot of people are deterred through the process. And we still can't get access to all the records. I mean, and for me, I mean, I think it's really critically important to protect Aboriginal people and families and communities as far as this is concerned. But we also need to educate our people and our communities on the importance of the material that is held in these places. And as I said before, to challenge the histories of the past. And this material can, you know, really overturn a lot of that stuff. Mm. And that's the problem we face. I mean, with our, you know, 6 or 7 year project on the protection board, we've only seen, you know, nowhere near all the material that's held there because it's restricted. And, you know, and there are reasons for that. But, you know, I've said that I know the DAA certainly get putting in a review, but the review's been going on for far too long. And the reality is we need to come out the other end of that, get something in place, and really, as I said, educate and involve our people in the decisions that go forward. Because, as I said, we can't challenge the past if we can't get access to the material. And the other thing is, for me, is the erasure, you know, the historical erasure of records that have been held in these places. And I mean, certainly with me, with the Protection Board and also the history of early Aboriginal political activism, you know, Pettit, the Secretary of the Protection Board, admitted clearly himself that back in the 20s and 30s, they were destroying records because it was incriminating of what they were doing. And that continued on through the 60s when it was shutting up. In the 70s, we know people were aware that records were being destroyed. So, you know, and interestingly enough, through this project, a very infamous figure as far as the Protection Board and the history of Aboriginal children being taken away is Inspector Donaldson. And, I mean, he had the reputation, you know, amongst Aboriginal communities as the kids collector, and for decades was responsible in removing so many Aboriginal kids and then seeing them institutionalised. I was contacted by his grandson, who agreed to do an interview with me. And when he died in the 30s, I mean, and this grandson was at the house. The house was at Coogee on the bluff at the top overlooking the sea. And he, in an interview to me, said that Donaldson's brother and even him as a kid were taking drawfuls of paper and tipping them over the back where the house was into the sea. You know, so there's complete destruction of records of what that individual was involved in. You know, so these are the obstacles we face, and that is, you know, important. And again, the other one, I may as well keep going while I'm on the subject, is I know for a fact that the AAPA records and those early Aboriginal activists, there's lots of references to the police through the board. The chair of the Protection Board was the police commissioner, but the police records, they're not there. There's nothing in the police records in regards to that organisation or those early Aboriginal activists. And what I was told many years ago, oh, there was a fire back in the day and all those records have gone up in smoke. So, you know, these are the issues we've faced. And but as I said, we've got to put this stuff together and get it out that our people, it's not looking at a deficit model, but the reality is, you know, we have a lot of inspiration in the past, and that's about uplifting our people and our communities and our families. We can only do it if we get access to it.
Because those instances that you cite, which, you know, were not, as you say, were not one-offs, are really chilling. And when I reflect on the fact that the way that my father was able to connect to his family was to find his mother's, my grandmother's Protection Board certificate. And without that piece of paper, he would not have known where he was from. And I guess you need to think about what the impact is of the destruction of those files. Could be that dislocation for people where they will never find out.
Mm, that's right, particularly with, as we know, stolen generations. I've been involved over many decades with interviews with members of the stolen generation and the traumatic experiences of their lives, trying to piece it together. They're all part of that giant jigsaw puzzle, which is Aboriginal history, with most of the pieces missing. But we've all got to play a part in putting those pieces back into the puzzle.
Kirsten, I'll just bring you in on that. Obviously, you must have observed similar things in relation to the difficulty in accessing and also the problems with the gaps in the archive. And I wonder if you've got some observations around that you'd like to share.
Yeah, and hearing John talk about, you know, the challenges of access, I think that, you know, the primary concern for navigating these spaces is thinking about the trauma and harm that people face when they enter. And I totally agree that we need to open things up, but also take that time and care for people and support them on their journey going into archive. I mean, I think there's so many myths about the archives. It's sort of, you know, we all go to the view of, you know, the underground, the Vatican, you know, the dusty, dark areas. But really, people made deliberate decisions about what was kept and what wasn't. And I think John's points around, you know, the deliberate destruction of records was in people's hands, but it was also in the legislation. So we didn't have that protection in the legislation for the subjects of records to be considered. And I think they're the changes that we're seeing today, that there's much more of a view and much more transparency on people thinking about, we can't fall into the situation again that we have gaps. We actually need to protect people who are under, you know, the legislation, having parts of their life controlled. So I think it, you know, there's always the idea of the repository is there. And, you know, I think for myself, having worked as an archivist, that there are a lot of decisions that are made without Aboriginal people participating. And that's the change that we're seeing now. We need people in there, you know, deciding on what's kept for the future. I mean, we all know that collecting in itself is a privilege. To keep anything requires, you know, people to spend time, put resources into, you know, storing, categorising material. So we need to make sure that we're in that picture now and keeping the things that need to be kept.
We've been talking, you know, about documentation, but of course the other thing that's kept in the archives is cultural materials and human remains. And I was just wondering if you could share with us what some of the arguments that have been put forward by collecting institutions about why they shouldn't repatriate and how this is shifting.
In my experiences, I think that that great silence that and erasure that John has spoken of has been at the forefront. I think that there's been a lot of shame in the major cultural institutions that they have collected things that we would consider now to be both highly inappropriate, unethical, and I guess they're grappling with how do they manage this now. And I don't know that up until recently, people talking about Indigenous cultural and intellectual property, I don't think we've had the right language to be able to think about the return of those materials. But we're seeing, I always talk about warriors in the archives. I think we're seeing, you know, a whole new workforce of people who are actually in there getting people prepared to have the really difficult conversations. And, you know, as John talked about, bringing that visibility to not only what the erasure was in terms of what was documented, but grappling and having a reckoning with some of the material that has been collected. And we see that with potency, with the collection of human remains. But I think the documents and the cultural knowledge is another factor that we're just entering into now.
Alison, you've done work analysing inquests into First Nations deaths in custody, but you've also been involved with the very real and emotional work of supporting families through coronial processes. Mm. And I was wondering if you can tell us what coronial inquests can tell us.
So coronial inquests are, maybe it's helpful to return to this, a very special kind of court which is almost entirely concerned with the creation of documentation around death. So they're not what people would expect of a typical court. There's no prosecution and defence. There's no two parties. What happens is that theoretically there's a large number of parties who are all trying to collaborate, again, theoretically, to find the truth. And instead what you find yourself with is a remarkably adversarial process in which families find themselves outgunned. And to watch the creation of those stories through the archives that ensue out of a coronial inquest is very difficult. Because ultimately what you are fighting for, if you are the family of someone who's passed away, particularly in custody, what you're fighting for is for the dignity of your loved one's story and for their memory, how they're going to be remembered in that archive. What they dig up is ultimately, if you pay attention to the creation of the story, something more interesting about the balance of power and the creation of documentation, which for me in my research has become a question of capture, the idea that state parties or other parties can come to dominate the story that an institution that's meant to hold them accountable can actually tell about them. And in that case, in my opinion, it's the use of New South Wales police and other state and territory police as investigative bodies for themselves that is an extraordinary grievance, and one that's not only contemporary but one that's been around since the Royal Commission and long before that, that police can tell stories about themselves that then go uncontested. So for me, the lesson in coroner's inquests is to pay attention to who's telling the story.
One of the aspects of Archie's work is the recreation of his own family tree, and he had problems finding materials in the archives, and I know reached out and was very grateful that you were able to help him a little bit with one of the pieces of those puzzles, and I wonder if you could share with us what that was.
I'm very honoured to have been asked to participate in this way and to lend the little support that I could to this piece. What we were looking for was historical documentation of his cousin, who was the subject of a coronial inquest in Bogabilla in the 1960s. What we came up against was the kind of tensions in documentation that both Kirsten and John have been talking about, this institutional slippages that are kind of painted as neutral, these gaps in documentation, this contempt of the paperwork where things are misscanned and documents about somebody's death are misplaced or treated with contempt. And I think ultimately it's all up to Uncle Archie to say whether that process was worth it. But I hope having that documentation and having that record has made Kith and Kin a small part what it is.
I'm sure. I know that it has. And as I mentioned, this element of actually using the archive to recreate a family tree is a big part of what he's doing. So, John, I wondered if you could share with us some of the things you've found out about your own family as you've searched the archives, because I know you have a great story in there, or actually several stories. But
how long's this program? To me, and all Aboriginal people, when they're putting together, you know, family histories, but the story that I come to put together, as I said, I grew up with those oral memories and also letters and photographs that the family retained. But it was only at the age of, 40 that, to give me a kick in the bum, my father wanted me, I was out of work and I'd just come out of a marriage and landed back home with him and my mother. And I don't know if they were too impressed about that, me lobbing back in again. But, he said, look, I want you to put the old man's story together for the family. So we've got that record down. And there was no idea then of, a PhD and books and journal articles and chapters and talks and all that sort of stuff, which, flowed on through the journey. But fundamentally, it was important to put it together, for my father, uncles, aunties, cousins, extended family members, and also so many Aboriginal people that I spoke to, that particularly at that time when I started out, old people that had memories of my grandfather and were recorded, and they're all gone now. But I have those recordings, which are so rich in their content to bring to life, those stories of the past and how important it is, that we have that material. And as I said, I've assisted so many others who, through my stuff, has just fed out and inspired others to take up the chase and fit themselves back into this puzzle, But it is, in this instance, a very inspiring story. And all of us have, critical stories embedded in our own family's past. And, I just encourage everybody to get out there and, put those stories together and, for your kids and your grandkids and for your communities. It's critically important.
I'm going to press you a little on this, because I think one thing about your family history that you've written about that I remember, because it's so powerful, is coming across letters that your grandfather had written advocating people who were actually trying to escape the control of the protection board, who were being mistreated. Mm. And I wonder what it felt like to find something, because you've all spoken about how when we're captured in the archive, our ancestors have been captured there, we actually do hear their voices when we find that material. Mm. And I having read something that you've written about that, it does stay with you. So I wonder what it was like for you to actually find that revelation of your grandfather and that work that he'd done in that form in his own words.
And it's important to understand, and Kirsten touched on this as well, there are stories in our past when we come to them that are really confronting and very, very sad as part of that, and it really sets you back. But the others, as I said, can be incredibly inspiring, although can bring you to tears, I recall one of the letters my grandfather wrote to a young Aboriginal girl in 1927 who'd been removed from a family placed into a station in Western New South Wales where she'd been raped by the manager of the station, became pregnant. She was only 14 when she was first placed there. When notified that she was pregnant, the Protection Board put her on a train, sent her to Sydney where she had the baby. And the records say that the baby died, but we're not to really know that. Maybe the baby was removed and, you know, put into care somewhere and disappears. That girl was then bunged on a train and sent back to the place of abuse. Now, my grandfather was informed of this by the incredible Aboriginal network across New South Wales that the AAPA had sent up. Now, he sent a 3-page letter to that young Aboriginal girl outlining if she could provide the details of the perpetrator, he would see this man in court. And he said, you know, I'm speaking to you as a big bro now. And listen, girlie, you are just but one of many of our girls who have suffered through this system, and I intend to do something about it. And it just went on. It was such a powerful letter. But, you know, every time I read, you know, parts of that letter, it just moves you to tears, you know, that this was happening to basically kids, you know, kids in that situation, and that Aboriginal people who were prepared to stand up and do something about it were then targeted, because that guy should have been the target, but he actually sent my grandfather's letter. The girl never saw the letter. This manager guy got the letter and then sent it back to the Protection Board. And in the reply is, you better see what's going on here and doing, and you need to do something about this. And, you know, I know from that point on the attacks against my grandfather and others like Sid Ridgway, Dick Johnston and Tom Lacey and Jane Duran and others was really ramped up. And we know today, and there's a lot of evidence to that, that the AAPA was, you know, or the Communist Party in 1931 in their report on slavery and Aborigines actually stated that the rank and file organisation set up by the Aborigines was allowed to be smashed by a coalition of the police, the Protection Board and the missionaries. So this was confronting to the authorities that they were being held accountable, because my grandfather was publishing stuff in the press, you know, in regards to this and outlining the horrors of experiences on the ground for Aboriginal people. So, you know, they certainly had to do something about it themselves in regards to that.
You're listening to Speaking Out.
It just comes down to showing, sharing, you know, respecting
the world from an Indigenous perspective on ABC Radio.
This is Speaking Out on ABC Radio, ABCRN, Radio Australia on podcast and the ABC Listen app. I'm Larissa Berendt, and if you like what you're hearing, why not rate us on your app, and that way other people can find us and hear our stories as well. Coming up, more from my conversation with Alison Whittaker, John Maynard and Kirsten Thorpe on Archie Moore's work at the Venice Biennale. But first, some music. Here's a track from Uncle Jimmy Little. It's his version of the go-between song Cattle and Cane from Uncle Jimmy's album Messenger.
Well, I recall a schoolboy walking home through fields of cane, to a house of tin and timber, and in the sky a rain of fallen cinders. From time to time the waste, memory wastes. La 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 make a brighter world, a world of books, of silent times and thought. And then the railway takes me home, through fields of cattle, fields of cane. Time to time the waste, memory wastes, and the waste, memory wastes, la la la. The same, a reply, a plan you once had, from time down to mind. The time was bad, so I knew where I was, alone, so at home.
That's Uncle Jimmy Little with Cattle and Cane.
This is Speaking Out.
That's the key to it all, keeping connected to country.
On ABC Radio.
Archie Moore is a Kamilaroi Bigambul artist whose work is known for its strong critique of colonial power structures and its celebration of First Nations sovereignty. He's being profiled in the Australian Pavilion at the Venice Biennale, where his work, Kith and Kin, has been installed. Like all of Archie's work, it looks at the way colonial institutions have sought to control First Nations people, but it also celebrates the resilience and resistance of Indigenous people. Kirsten, John's talked about how important it was to find those letters and the other pieces he's found out about his family through the archive search, and I've mentioned the importance of my grandmother's protection board certificate. We all then, in a way, reclaim what we find in these colonial archives for ourselves in our own way. And I just wondered, what are the pieces of archival or documented history that are really important as part of your family story and your family tree? What are your treasures?
You know, it's interesting. I think we're probably in the middle, that there's just been traces of family, and that probably speaks to people wanting to disengage from the protection board. So I probably have similar experience of knowing oral history and then sort of having lines of information, particularly the protection board, giving my mum's grandmother child endowment funds, and I guess imagining her going in to receive that money and what that looked like. Although we did have some great stories, also being Waramai, like John, of my mum's grandmother and great-grandmother going into the middle of Port Stephens when the protection board came and having to row away for that sense of safety. And when I started working at the New South Wales State Archives, I found this incredible school record that said Rose Newland was absent from school due to rough seas. And that kind of confirmed all those oral histories of the fact that she had to travel from one side of the water to the other for her schooling. And I think, you know, for me, I had an interest in history. I'd had an interest in, you know, hearing those stories. So when I went to the archives, it was so surprising to me to see that in most people's experiences, there was the one page, there was the few lines. And I think unless the board was particularly surveilling a community, there are a lot of people who can't find information. And sometimes that is even more traumatic than being able to find whole records. But As John said, the stories and the advocacy that sits in the archives, I think that's the stuff that we need people to connect with and celebrate. Even for me, that story of resilience and understanding the water. I think she missed her sewing class, which was also quite funny in the exam. So those tiny little pieces help you make sense of other memories as well.
What about you, Alison? Are there particular family treasures? How's your family tree stayed strong?
My family tree has stayed strong mostly through oral recollections. I have this fantastic memory a couple of years ago sitting down at the table with Nan with a cup of tea and a pen of paper and just tracing back everything we could remember. Yeah. Unfortunately for me, the written documentation is quite painful to visit, and so we don't look at it for that reason.
But it's interesting, isn't it, that the colonial system values what's written, but what's really important to us are those stories.
Yeah.
We've got a really strong tradition around that. One of the strong aspects of Archie's work is always, there's always a very strong theme of the assertion of sovereignty through it. So while he might look at something that has been a process of colonisation, he's always very strong about the fact that there is a very active assertion of our sovereignty as First Nations people that we do by action. Alison, you work in a highly colonised space in the criminal justice system, so I'm not going to ask you blanketly how we decolonise that, or much like John's work, we'll be here all day. But I wonder if you could maybe point to a couple of strategies that are close to your heart in terms of what you think does need to happen in terms of assertion of our sovereignty or reclaiming our space around these issues in the criminal justice system?
In the criminal justice system, I would say probably one of the most significant things we can do to the extent that it's in our power is to prevent its, as you kind of mentioned earlier, its surveilling power by refusing to engage with it where possible. And I think, as others before me have said far more eloquently, the general practice of refusal is a long-term one that we've been practicing for a long time. And ultimately, that's not just about refusing to be colonized to the extent that is within our power, which is not always very much, but the understanding that we build things elsewhere that don't have to be known, that don't have to be documented, that can just be ours and can be untouched.
And Kirsten, from your perspective, we've talked about the process that archives play in colonization. What are some of the strategies that you think, again, it's a big question as to how we decolonize that, but what are a few of the strategies that are close to your heart in terms of how we address that?
I mean, I'd like to imagine that every community had a living archive that people could connect with, and thinking of a future that those stories were held locally and they were accessible to people, that we could perhaps, you know, John's talked about the challenges of access, that communities could control the materials that are now sitting in government, but that we also expand those materials so that younger generations can kind of find themselves connected to that material. I think we've got a long way to go with that. And I think, you know, the digital space offers a lot of opportunities. We, you know, we've got such challenges in terms of keeping digital content. People are recording things on YouTube, they're taking pictures, you know, where is that going? And, you know, that's something that I'm thinking about a lot in my work. You know, we need to see that history is being made today, and we need to make sure that it's being cared for in the right way, and also that we get rid of things that don't belong to be kept. I think sort of a very Western construct that we need to keep things, but also things have time and purpose, so working that out in a community I think is really important. But also having people engaged and using that in multiple ways, so if it is in artwork, if it is in telling other stories, that they don't have to spend all this time going to a major institution in often a city, or, you know, going to Canberra to access material, but there are new ways for us to connect with that material.
John, of course, this concept of the assertion of sovereignty that Archie embraces has a long history amongst our people. And I wonder if you could share, in the significant work you've done on the rights movement of the 1920s, what that work and that activism tells us about the long-standing assertion of First Nations sovereignty.
Yeah, well, in my grandfather's words, we have overriding rights above all others in our land. I think that's the fundamental thing, and that was being said 100 years ago. So that hasn't changed. And I mean, all the things that were tabled by the AAPA back in the 1920s, you know, demanding enough land for each and every Aboriginal family in the country. That was a national land rights agenda, you know, demanding that the practice of the Protection Board in removing Aboriginal kids from their families had to be stopped, and the Aboriginal family life had to be protected and ensured that the family life stayed as a unit. The significance of recognising a distinct Aboriginal cultural identity and its protection, that was another thing that was on the table. And the manifesto that they put out in 1927, interestingly enough, you know, demanded that all the protection boards be abolished and had to be replaced by an all-Aboriginal board to sit under the Commonwealth Government. And that's a voice to Parliament basically 100 years ago. So this was the stuff that was being tabled by Aboriginal people at the time, and no one knows the situation better than us. And this was the people's movement. You know, it grew into a membership of 600, 14 branches, 4 sub-branches, and held 4 conferences. And then that was an amazing achievement, particularly in the face of police harassment, and more than police harassment, I have to say, you know, and that's another story in itself.
Of course, Archie's work, which has such strong First Nations thematics that are totally of this country, sits at the Venice Biennale in an international context. I'm just wondering if you can, each of us in the areas that you're working in, give us a bit of a sense of what you see as the international connections we have in those areas. So I guess for you, Kirsten, in terms of the work you're doing in the space of archives here in Australia, what are some of the concurrent movements that and connections that you have around the world globally that have a synergy with what we're doing here?
John talked earlier about the fact that, you know, libraries, archives weren't places that First Nations people globally were here and globally connected with. And I think we've sort of had that polite time of feeling like, fantastic, these institutions have opened themselves up, sometimes doing that well and other times, you know, still needing to improve their practices. But I think, you know, for me, at least over the last decade, that sense of politeness has now turned more to demands of things that need to change. So I'm seeing, you know, really exciting work and collaboration internationally where people are sharing practices, sharing ways that they can consider things like community stewardship of knowledge, community care of information so it is on country. And although the situations are different and people have faced different types of state sanction control, I think the archival legacy is very similar. And what we see is that people couldn't participate in both a right of reply to that information, but also, you know, decisions about how things are used. So that's definitely at our forefront now. I think, you know, we're hearing a lot about the data sovereignty movement and the Indigenous data sovereignty movement. And for me, and even hearing again John talking about, you know, his family history and the sense of what a movement is, I think I'm really excited by that. I'm excited by people speaking of things like sovereignty, so we're not in this situation that things are given to us because people have goodwill. And I think in the sector, a lot of people want to make change, but they're not willing to let go of power. And I think the data sovereignty movement is a new assertion. And there's certainly a sense of collaboration and sharing that we all have, I guess, this confrontation and encounter with the archive that is very different. And I'm always humbled and so willing to learn from those other international movements to see what we can bring back here and make sense of it in our own way.
What about you, Alison? There are obviously global movements around reform in the criminal justice system. But for you personally, what are some of those international movements or conversations or philosophical streams that are particularly resonant for you?
When I was thinking about, I know this is makes me a bad listener, as you were giving your response, I was trying to think of places of international solidarity or resonance. And my mind kept going back to what it felt like to stand at Town Hall in June 2020 and to see 26,000, I think the estimate was, people turn up to a rally that they knew to be unauthorized during lockdown in order to stand in solidarity with Mob and the global Black Lives Matter movement. And for me, that was just like witnessing a massive global potential in solidarity that really thrilled me. And we're seeing the impacts of that now. And they are obviously, I'm thinking about the coroner's court in particular, watching in New South Wales, the introduction of the First Nations protocol that's been particularly, I think, has been used to the benefit of some families who have experienced the death in custody of a loved one, and the inclusion of Aboriginal support officers in the coroner's court. And these things are small and they're never enough and they're liable to co-optation. But to see them build and to see the potential that that represents, to me, is such a thrill.
John, I feel like this is going to be a hard question for you in terms of the amount of work you've done in this area, but I was wondering if you could share with us some of the things that have resonated with you in terms of the international influences and philosophies and movements, particularly around the work of the AAPA and those early rights movements. I think they show we've got a long history of international exchange and collaboration, but I wonder if you could share some of that work with us.
Yeah, sure. I mean, particularly with the AAPA and my grandfather and other Aboriginal activists at that time period working on the docks, coming into contact with African Americans, West Indians, Africans, Islanders, and I mean, and comparing, I guess, the what was going on. And my grandfather clearly understood from that point in time that everything that we were facing here just wasn't confined to this country. It wasn't a localised or regional thing. It was an international fight, and that's where it needed to be challenged. And I mean, it continued on through Aboriginal history. We know in the 60s, I mean, it was Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and Muhammad Ali and Black Power, and I mean, and all my stuff as well in connections with the Native American or the First Nations experiences in Canada and the United States. There's a great quote that I recall, you know, from one of my heroes, Malcolm X, and he said that in 1964, just before his assassination, that he said oppressed people around the world are, you know, coming together. We're beginning to compare notes, and we realise that this fight has to be fought internationally. And that's the space we're still in. And you can see that clearly of what's happening in the Middle East, you know, and the shocking conditions of what's happening in Gaza. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's just horrific. And to me, that's a mirror image of our experience here, invasion, occupation, dispossession, cultural destruction and genocide. So these are the things we need to stand up for, because it's a continuation of this treatment. So that just can't be condoned. I mean, I look back, I mean, in 2005, I was part of a 75,000 crowd in Washington, D.C., a pro-Palestinian get-together. And then only last year, there's 200,000 in London and a pro-Palestinian march. And these are the things people need to get behind and, I mean, support. We know, I mean, what has happened to us, and we've got to recognise that and fight for the rights of others as well as ourselves.
Mm. Well, one last question for each of you. Archie, of course, represents Australia at the Biennale, but I think we would all feel he represents First Nations people first, and I feel like he would feel that too. And I wondered if each of you could share with us another First Nations artist's work that resonates with you. We've got a wonderful range to choose from, so it's probably, again, very hard to pick just one, but I wonder if you could share with us someone's work that also resonates with you. Start with you, Kirsten.
You know, because we're on the theme of archives and knowing that Judy Watson's work is coming up to the gallery in Queensland, Judy Watson had a series called Blood Language, where she talks about these tensions between the archive and her family, but also the struggles, and blood is represented in that. So that's very special to me, thinking about, I guess, the body and people engaging with the archives. It can be that joy that John has talked about, or a moment that people have to refuse. So that would be something that resonates. But, you know, having, you know, considered Archie's work, there's just so much in that around family history that I'm so excited to see the stuff that comes up out at the Biennale. Not that I think I'll be over in Venice, but being able to engage with that, yeah.
What about you, John?
Well, I mean, politically, it has to be Richard Bell. I can't go anywhere else with it.
Who in his own way has already been at the Biennale.
Yeah, he's been there stamped down. But, you know, from a political angle, I mean, yeah, that's what he stamps down with his artwork is really, it does confront the establishment, and justly so. And, you know, his powerful work resonates very powerfully with me. But I will just say, I mean, I wrote a piece for Archie in the past, and it was a booklet that was published, I think, by the Art Gallery of New South Wales. But I said that, in essence, Archie Moore captured through his art this conflicted landscape and stamps down with authority that we were and remain a sovereign people. And I think that's the essence that comes down through me again from someone like Archie Moore. So, you know, extremely powerful in his artwork.
Lovely. Alison?
I'm going to take some maybe leeway with the question and suggest a literary figure, which is Alexis Wright, who I think just represents incredibly the ambition and rigour of First Nations literature here. Praiseworthy is a feat. I'll recommend it to anybody who'll listen.
I think that is absolutely appropriate. In fact, there was a part of me that was almost willing you to take the literary path, given your own contribution in that field. Well, thank you so much, all of you, for the work that you do in your own spaces to decolonize and to assert sovereignty, for allowing us to think a little bit more deeply about some of the thematics that Archie's trying to get us to think about in his work, and for spending time with us on Speaking Out.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Alison Whittaker, John Maynard and Kirsten Thorpe. We've been discussing Kith and Kin, the artwork of Gamilaroi Bigambul artist Archie Moore that's showing at the Venice Biennale in the Australian Pavilion. That's the show for now. Join us again next time for more inspiring stories from across Indigenous Australia.
They need to be recognised, and we just got to bring it out into the open and say, well, our people did fight for this country, and it goes back right back into history, including the Boer War and every other war after that. And our people put up their hands and says, yeah, I'll come out and join in too. And for a variety of reasons. But they came back without recognition. They didn't. Many of them didn't get their soldiers' benefits and all those kinds of things. Like my grandfather, for example, who fought in the Light Horse, buried up in Gympie in an unmarked grave. And I just think that's an injustice in terms of the non-recognition of our people. And when they did come back from the war, they came back under a very, very apartheid system and still brought up under the Aboriginal Protection Acts, even though they'd fought for the country.
Speaking Out is produced by Jay McAllister and Sarah Allerley, and you can email the program speakingout@abc.net.au and find us on social media via ABC Indigenous. I'm Larissa Berendt.